This is Dave Fletcher, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 25th of April, 2012. Dave Fletcher, Part 1.
My name is David Fletcher. I was born on 28th of June, 1948, in Wokingham in Berkshire.
So you're now how old?
63, 64 in June.
It's nice to interview somebody so young. Tell me about your parents.
Bless them. Yeah, sadly both gone now. Both again from Berkshire, from Warfield, from a family that's actually worked in the Great Forest since the 14th century. But again, sadly, I don't think I gave them the credit they deserved when they were alive. They did things and did things that I didn't appreciate at the time, but they supported me in doing strange things. I mean, like when I left school, I turned down a university place because I wanted to go climbing for a year. I went climbing in Abu Dhabi. And, you know, when you think of it afterwards, you know, there's mum sort of, you know, thinking their son's going off to this wonderful sort of academic world and he's turning it down to go climbing. But there was never, ever a hint of don't do that. You know, it was always supportive.
What was your father's job?
My father actually was he was an artist, actually. He worked for a company called Wokingham Plastics and designed all their screen printing screens, basically, and was a freelance artist himself, but mainly doing cutting and designing on screen printing. And again, very understated. He never pushed himself forward, which, again, after the war, sort of six long years in the war, I just think he didn't feel that he just wanted a job and settled down, you know, whereas he could have gone much farther.
Was he a good artist?
He was very good.
Have you got examples of his work still?
Yes, I have, up in the loft, sadly, but I got to get them reprinted. But he did things like, I remember when I was young, he used to line out traction engines and things like that.
What, the real thing?
Yeah, the big ones. You know, when the whole movement was obviously, you know, as I realised later, the whole movement was just started with Stealing. But he used to go and he would do the flywheel, the lining on the flywheel, and he'd just spin the flywheel and just boom, do it by hand. Amazing.
What was his name?
Donald. My middle name, yeah.
And your mother, did your mother have a job?
Not really. She was, if you like, the classic housewife. But superb cook, tremendous knitting, you know, I mean, if you like, the traditional 50s housewife. And again, you know, I mean, so many of the things she made and did for me, again, you don't actually appreciate at the time.
What about the school? Was it private or public or state?
No, it was a grammar school, very old-fashioned grammar, Ranelagh Grammar School, which started in Wakefield in 1658, I think, and then ended up in Bracknell, near Wokingham. 200 boys, 200 girls. Absolutely superb school, actually. And again, you don't appreciate just how good it was until you leave. I look at our local schools here, and they're great schools, don't get me wrong. But I mean, if we had a sixth form of about 25 leavers each year, 30 leavers, and everybody went to university. It was that sort of standard.
But you did, if you had gone, which one, where would you have gone? And what?
Eventually. I went to Bristol.
But at that time?
At that time, I had a place at Oxford.
To read?
Yeah. I was going to read geography at Lincoln, but I turned it down.
So where did the passion for climbing come from then?
I'd always climbed trees when I was a baby. And then, again, I used to climb at High Rocks in Sussex. I used to take the train from Wokingham, which went right through to Guildford and then change. And when I was 14 or 15. And also, at school, we had... well, can only be say an inspired master, you know, who really, again, he'd probably be locked away at this time of year. You know, what he allowed was fantastic, and he ran a climbing club, so we'd have sort of excursions literally all over the country when I was 15, 16, and that really inspired it. And then this year out, I rang Abu Dhabi. I'd gone to Abu Dhabi as a student.
Abu Dhabi?
The Outward Bound School at Abu Dhabi. And again, the school had two places, but it was grossly expensive. I mean, it was £130, and this was in 1964. And I'd said to Mum and Dad, oh, I put my name down. And I didn't think. And they obviously had a huge struggle raising the money. But there was no hesitation. And that transformed my life, really. Because I had that 26 days at Abu Dhabi. Then I went into the sixth form. And that's when I'd finished. And I didn't want to go to university. I just wanted to go climbing. And I rang Abu Dhabi and said, I mean, it's just incredible what you think. I just rang them and said, have you got any places for an instructor? And I mean, there I was sort of an 18-year-old. And the warden, Freddie Fuller, rang me back and said, come as a temporary instructor. And I actually ended up there as a year. And the thing that changed my life is that three members there was Johnny Green, who was the purser, ex-bass, Ian Fothergill, ex-base commander, Hope Bay, Mick Cousins, ex-base commander, Stonington. And they were the three that, you know, changed my life.
I find it hard to believe that you would have spent a year in their company and they would not have mentioned the Antarctic.
Oh, no. Well, everything was... I mean, where we used to climb was a place called Tom Fanai. And, of course, it was called Tonners after Stonners. You know, there was this sort of thing in the centre. Yes, and indeed, it just transformed my... I mean, I'd obviously heard of the Antarctic, and you know, but I didn't really know... connections, and suddenly I had these connections, and that was what I was going to do.
Can you remember the sort of things they might have said which would have caught your imagination?
Two things, actually, strange things. One was nothing to do with the Antarctic. One was Mick Cousins telling me about the whaling stations in South Georgia. Because when he came out, they just closed, literally, you know, because he came out in 69, so they closed in 65, of course. I was fascinated by these massive factories in the middle of nowhere that were sort of, you know, closed down as if somebody had just gone out for a cup of tea. You know, so that changed my thinking about all these things completely. I mean, up until then, I was doing a teacher's degree at St Paul's at Cheltenham. I was playing very serious rugby, first class rugby. That was my future, basically. Until I went to this place, and the whole thing changed.
Was there a second thing you were going to mention?
Yes, indeed. My apology. Yeah, it was that. Then also the concept of dog sledging, the concept of just going on base and being given a project, and you just sledged into the sunset, basically. It was this...
That sounds really romantic.
It did, you know. And it was a bit like that, you know. I mean, when I went to Halley, I mean, my first base, you know, it was you just literally... And most, I suppose I was lucky because I'd done a lot of snow and ice climbing, but most of the lads I went south with had no real sort of, you know, what you would call training. I mean, I just shudder to think in this day and age is our health and safety. I mean, I just cannot even imagine it happening, you know. But that was one of the things that really, those two things. The whaling stations, that I just had this, couldn't come to terms with this sort of great mass of things in the middle of nowhere. And the concept of going on base... without a sort of rigorous regime of training and learning and just literally sledging into the sunset.
Yeah. Boys own adventure type stuff.
Yeah.
So what happened then at the end of your year at Abu Dhabi?
I was virtually... again, I wanted to go south straight away, actually. But I've, again, good people. The warden there, a chap called Freddie Fuller, virtually insisted that I went to university, really. I mean, and of course, again... it made an awful lot of sense, you know, and to get a formal qualification and pursue my rugby really as well. It's because Gloucester wanted me to play for them, but I stayed at Harlequins, and you know, there was things like this going on at the time. I mean, I had the most ridiculous interview at St Paul's I've ever known.
At Cheltenham,
yeah. I went for an interview, and the interview basically consisted of, would you be prepared to play flanker rather than number eight? And that was essentially the interview.
So the rugby preceded all that. When did you start?
I started playing rugby back in the 50s. I mean, when I was at primary school. The primary school again played rugby, played cricket, played football, played everything really, which again is completely different from modern days. And then Ranelagh was very much the grammar school was very much a rugby school, and they had places as well at Richmond and Harlequins and sides like that, and I'd got a place at Harlequins, so I was playing sort of junior Harlequins when I was still at school.
But you did moderately well, didn't you? I seem to recall.
Yeah.
What was the pinnacle of your rugby career?
I basically get in the cap for the England students. I played for England students against Scotland and against Wales. And I was actually in the, it didn't have squads in those days, but I was in the mix maybe for going for an England trial. I never did, but I was playing pretty consistently for Harlequins. And
amateur?
Amateur, yeah. Computer. Yeah. Well, yes. Expenses on travel. And, amateur inverted commas. Yes, very much so, actually. Yeah. Yeah. And I loved it, actually. But actually, again, it was funny how things change out. By the time I'd finished 3 years of college, where I was playing rugby for St Paul's and rugby for Harlequins, I was losing, not losing enthusiasm for rugby. I played rugby until a year ago. I still play, and I'm hoping to play in a few weeks' time. But I'd lost the enthusiasm for, if you like, top-class rugby, professional rugby. It was everything that I don't like about professional rugby now. You know, this driven to do things for a game, and it just lost, for me, it lost the beauty of the game.
It's no longer the sport of gentlemen.
No. It's... there's still some wonderful players, but it's just driven the wrong way. I mean, I still follow sides like Gloucester and Harlequins. Of course, I'd rather go down and see my own little rugby club and see the juniors play. To be quite honest, it's fresh for me. I lost that, if you like, that competitive drive. Just played too much when I was young, I think, and didn't really see a future. And fortunately, because there was no future in rugby in those days, but when I was sort of saw this, if you like, the option of going south.
we'll come to that in a minute. Yeah. St Paul's in Cheltenham is a teacher training college.
It was a teacher's training college, specialist in peer physical education. I mean, it was up with Luke's, Loughborough, Cardiff. It was that sort of standard. Produced some fantastic sportsmen.
So you turned your back on the academic world then?
I did, completely, really. But I never have, if you see what I mean.
You have to elaborate on that.
I mean, the things I really enjoy now, and I've done for years, is actually the logistics of science. We'll obviously talk about it later, but one of my periods in the Antarctic, I was base commander at Cygni for 5 years. It was probably the most fulfilling time of my life. Was seeing young scientists coming on base in their first year and then developing over 3 years. And many of them now are world's top scientists. And seeing that development. And I always used to tell them the adage, first year, first summer, if you like, forget it. It's a waste of time. Second summer, you learn your trade. And the third summer, you actually do some work.
So in what way were you helping these chaps achieve what they wanted to achieve?
Lateral thinking, I think, would probably be the word. Because you probably know yourself. And it was one of the problems I had when I was doing academic things. I tended to be very blinkered. And the thing I found I could offer them at Cygni was a lateral look at things. I insisted on sampling with every scientist on the base at least once a week. So I could understand what they were trying to do. I could also understand their requirements. Because I often felt, and again, this hence onto the communication thing, they weren't supported, basically. And that's no disrespect to Bass. It was a simple matter of, of telexes and the impossibility of, communication at times. So they were on their own. And I just really enjoyed, if you like, giving them the platform to do their science, basically. And I still do. I still do a lot of work with universities in Germany and other sort of educational groups. And I mean, I did for many years run a thing in Greenland where several friends of mine who run chairs at universities were finding they were funded for a field trip at the end of the season. Everybody went out on the field trip. And of course, sadly, the young people, perhaps in their second year at university, had never sampled in the ice, had never sampled in the wind, and just everything failed. And the whole field course turned out to be a waste of time. And I, while funding was good, I used to run this little course where we would teach them to sample in gloves, batteries stopped in the wind, all these sort of things. and real basic stuff, so that when they actually came to their proper field trip, they were thinking on how they might, you know, improve their situation,
how they get around the adversity.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you say sampling, what do you mean?
They would the one particularly is a university, two universities in Germany, Kiel and Jena, where they do a polar ecology course. So there are some botanists, there are some geologists, there are some, you know, there's a whole raft of different sciences within this polar ecology course. And many of them are sort of sampling, ice samplings, doing shallow drill cores, that type of thing. And a lot of people working on plants, for example. And, of course, that many of them minute sort of micro temperatures and things like that. Well, most of this stuff was all done in the laboratory perfectly well. But, of course, as soon as you put it in on the Greenland ice cap, forget it, you know. And
just, was this also true in the Antarctic, or was that...?
It was initially, because many of the people involved in it were Antarctic people. Right. You know, I mean, the chap who runs the thing at Jena was at the Russian station at Bellingshausen for many years, and I knew him down there. So it sort of extended north.
So in your weekly get-together on Cygni with a scientist, talk me through the kind of exchange that might take place. Typical or classic exchange?
Well, Cygni Base was in not a very good position. So to get anywhere from Cygni Base, you either had to take a boat or you had to walk. And I always offered myself forward as a Sherpa, basically. I'd either run the boat for them to take them to the other side of the bay so they could then walk on to wherever, you know, they were going. Or Sherpa, because most of them, with the old-fashioned kit and batteries and goodness knows what else, was a fairly major logistical exercise. So I would offer myself as a Sherpa. But in that Sherpering, I wouldn't actually tell them that I was coming to watch them sample, because these sort of lads would feel that was an infringement of their professionalism, whatever. Mm. Intrusive. But I wanted to understand what they were doing, because part of the job as base commander, I think I needed to know what they were doing, or I could read the. I could read the script, if you like. But I wanted to see what... Equally, I wanted to see him, so I could then put in ideas. I could support them. And I just felt it was a good way of pulling the team together, basically.
It must have been rather unusual for Bass to have a GA as a base leader who could have got an Oxford degree.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But then that came about, strangely, by a disaster, really. Well, not a disaster, but when I went to Halley, I was originally going to do 2 years at Halley as a dog driver doing the Shackleton programme, which Shackleton's about 400 miles south of Halley, I was going to be doing the dog driving, which had been quite successful over the previous years. And part of the arrangement was the Americans flew a Herc in, which flew us down to the Shacks. But that year, the Herc wasn't available. So the program essentially collapsed, if you like. Pete Clarkson was the geologist, and he was going to come in and we were flying down, but that didn't happen. So essentially I had a year at Halley. Okay, it wasn't a wasted year. We did quite a lot of the work on glacial lines and survey and so on, but the whole point of the next summer had gone. So the other GA was down there, a bloke called Jack Donaldson. He was basically sent home, really. His contract was terminated because their Stonington was full. And I got this thing saying, would I be prepared to take over as a base commander at Cygni on a, you know, sort of, you know, for that summer? It turned out to be a permanent job eventually, but I said, yeah, okay, sounds great. You know, again, I sort of my biological background and whatever, I thought, yeah, lovely, super. I mean, I was disappointed because I did really want to go into the Shacks, and equally I would have gone quite happy to Stonington. But I felt, yeah, it sounds good. And so that was how I got to Cygni. So that was, a mistake, if you like, anyway.
And is it true to say that you were the first professional base leader for Bass?
Three of us, actually, or two of us. Me and Steve Wormold were the first two, and then Mick Pawley after that. I took over at Cygni, Steve took over at Adelaide, and then, of course, set up Rotherham, and Mick at South Georgia.
Were you aware of any decision-making behind that, of Bass beginning to realise that they needed professional chaps in
only
charge?
After it happened. I didn't really realise at the time. I just felt quite privileged I was asked.
What did you learn in retrospect? What did you learn later about that process?
What do you mean as far as the office was concerned?
Or? Well, the fact that you were, they were going for professional base leaders.
Having seen what had gone on at Signy before, it was a tremendous idea. there'd been no continuity. And don't get me wrong, there'd been some really excellent base commanders at Signy and other stations as well. But it was a lottery, because you might really get a good bloke one year and the next bloke, though you might do a disaster. Because, I mean, many of them just said, OK, well, I'm a scientist, I'll do the science. And the base commander and went sort of out the window. As the permanent base commander, the greatest benefit I've found, or I thought from previous years, was the fact I could actually go back to the office in those days, London, and then Cambridge, to actually carry on the ordering process, you know, the personnel process, you know, where people perhaps weren't making it, people that needed more support. I can follow that up. Whereas as a previous way we used to do it, there was no follow-up, really.
But you were aware of a clear decision in the Bass management in 1972?
Yes, I was, yeah.
This had to happen.
It did. There'd been a couple of epics. I mean, there was, at all bases, but at Signy there was a sort of couple of things, and they went off in an open boat to Car. This is about 25 miles away, and you know, there were things going on that really needed controlling, basically. And the thinking also regarding the GAs was they felt GAs, if you like, had a better overview, obviously, of safety, because we were field personnel. And one of the problems, as you probably know, of places like Argentine Islands, Signy, was that you had non-field personnel in field situations and wanting to go farther. And, of course, that was a problem with Faraday right the way until the end, basically. I think it was a good step forward, and I did become aware of it, but not at the time of being asked to go.
And it worked as a policy?
It did. It did work, yeah. It did work. It got a real, got a much better grip of the situation, got a much better grip of the logistics or ordering, if you like, as well. Because again, the way of ordering your indents was a pretty hit and miss affair, but it actually could have been catastrophic. Because I mean, you're indenting this year essentially for 2 years' time, and if you didn't bother, then the lads on the base in 2 years' time had a nightmare scenario. They either had too much or nothing at all. And that was a pretty hit-and-miss affair. And this, again, began to give a bit of a consolidation on the sort of logistics and the order. It became much more organised, yeah.
We'll come back to Signy and to Halley later on, but at the moment you're still wearing your gym shorts at St Paul's. the teacher training course at St Paul's would be, is that 2 years?
Three.
3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
In what way do you, looking back on that, in what way do you feel that kind of equipped you for what later evolved in your life in the Antarctic?
One of the greatest things was the fact I spent a year out at Abu Dhabi before I went there. Mm. If I'd have gone there, I'd have just been a schoolboy going one more year. But having had a year out, I really appreciated the course, actually. Again, we had good people, good instructors. But what I enjoyed about it was, if you like, the overview of life. I mean, I was playing an awful lot of sport, and it was very sport orientated, but it had a lot of educational sides, and so it really gave you a fuller view of things.
So fitness?
Fitness. I was fit as 10. I mean, I was obviously fit from playing rugby, climbing. I was, you know, as fit as I've ever been in my life, basically.
Was there a medical element?
There was. We did quite a detailed physiology course, part of a PE course. It was, if you like, it was sort of modern magic, because it only just really started, you know. And again, I was involved in that with playing rugby, because injuries in those days, which I suffer from now, you ran it off, whatever it was. You know, you got a twisted knee, well, just run it off, you know. Where in fact, you should have had a week out, whatever. That didn't happen, you know. And we were becoming aware of that. And again, no, it happens. There's no point. We were, at senior club level, being given steroids and things like that, which we had really no concept of what they were. We knew they weren't. We really shouldn't be taking these things, but you didn't, because you were playing that sort of level. And so there were many things that we're becoming aware of, and the course helped us with these type of things. It helped us enormously. And also, again, I was very impressed with the responsibility the lecturers gave us, because I virtually ran the outdoor program at St Paul's in my year, because the lad there actually said to me, and he said, look, you've got far more experience than I have in this, and this is, let's do this together. Fantastic, you know. And I'm all right, there was no loss of control from the lecturer's point of view, but it was excellent, you know, being able to help and plan and be involved.
So were there skills you picked up on that three-year course which you found yourself consciously employing in your later work?
Yes, yeah. I mean, there was, especially training, things like that. And I still do, you know, I mean, yeah, if you like, simple things. I used to do on base and stretching exercises and things like that, which again came from the course. But also on the education side as well, it was interesting. We had a real mix of education lecturers. I mean, some I wouldn't have given you boot room. but there were a couple that were quite inspiring, you know, on because you, it was, I suppose it was just the sort of time, and I really feel for teachers now, where sort of classroom discipline was going out of the window. You know, people were beginning to lose respect for teachers, and of course you had these people saying, yes, well, classroom discipline, you get their interest. Well, yeah, fine. I mean, I had a great example. My second teaching practice, I was at Linden Street for Boys in Gloucester. Made the Bass Street kids look like beginner's playtime. You know, my first lesson, I had 90 kids in a gym, one football. That is it. That was the total, you know. But in the end, I really enjoyed it because I was able to do things with these kids. And because you do things, they appreciated it. You know, I ran a football team on a Saturday. I really thought nobody would turn up. In the end, I had 20 kids because there's so many wanted to play. And, you know, it was this, and it was very fulfilling for me. Hard work. But it was that, and it was those type of things I learnt. You know, I mean, I had a couple of very inspired teachers. I mean, one of them, Sid, I mean, I could have killed him on the first thing because he was a dance teacher. And he said, well, get him to do dance at Linden Street for Boys. I thought, this is going to be, I should end up lynched it. You know, most of these lads are from Matson and the back end of Gloucester. Yeah. But they really actually took to it. Okay, in a different, I mean, I always remember one of them, a bloke called Clive Avis. I got him to give a piece of music to do the dance to, and I hadn't really thought of history. Well, of course, what he brought in was the stripper. And I thought, yeah, you're right, you know. But so it was lots of lateral thinking and lots of different aspects, which you didn't pull them all together at the time, but I felt, I really did broaden my sense of education.
So same question again. What skills did you learn at St Paul's that you then applied to the Antarctic? Were you getting the fits to do physical jerks at 5 a.m?
Yeah. No, I was getting them to do stretching.
Right.
I mean, people I used to take sledging because, you know, we get very stiff. You know, you run behind a sledge for 30 miles a day.
Was that new in the Antarctic?
Newish.
Yeah.
Newish. I remember Bill Sloman actually at the conference at Cambridge. Saying, well, you're going to do physical stretches on the ship. And I thought, what? You know, but it was quite new, actually. Yeah.
Nobody else had mentioned it. So
no, yeah. That's right. And there was a Met man going to Adelaide who'd also done a PE degree, somehow I was renamed. But he was our, we did it together anyway. So, yeah, that was quite new. But one of the things I took from St Paul's to the Antarctic, which more when I was at Sydney, was dealing with people. Really. I mean, I dealt with kids. Well, kids are older than me at Abu Dhabi, but it was a different situation because you knew what they were doing. They didn't. They were in a dangerous position. Therefore, they would look to you to get them out of trouble. That's fine. But in the Antarctic, you were very much equal or often inferior academically to many others. And it was this ability to deal with people that I'd learned at St Paul's that I did find a huge bonus, actually.
Okay. So what, in the end, made you want to go to the Antarctic? And when did you apply? Was it straight from St Paul's?
Yeah, yes, it was straight from St Paul's, yeah. Again, I got so involved with Antarctic people. And, I mean, after Abu Dhabi, when I was at St Paul's, I'd work in the summer at a little outdoor centre up in Derbyshire. Which again, Ian Fothergill had moved on to, and then I'd met people like Tony Bushell and Mick Pawley and all those, and so it was inevitable, really. And I got, and I mean, my my three referees were Johnny Green, Mick Cousins, and Ian Fothergill. And when I went for an interview at Bass, you know, Fuchs and Sloman were, and basically the comment was, well, if this bunch, you've either got to be really good or terrible.
you had to apply, you weren't invited.
Oh, no, I had to apply, yeah.
And you were applying for a GA post.
I applied for a GA, yes, because of my background of climbing, and you know, and I had actually done some dog sledging, not a lot, but I'd done some dog sledging in Greenland on a climbing trip there, so it wasn't completely new to me, but I'd done a lot of glacier work, so...
It sounds like you were an ideal candidate, so was the interview a bit of a formality?
It was, really, but I was still incredibly nervous, but... you know, and I knew the way it would go because all these lads had told me, well, if you're asked to go to medical, you pretty much got it then, you know. And of course, and I was able to, and folks talked to me about what I would do if I fell down a crevasse. It was actually, I didn't tell him, but I mean, that summer I'd actually been down a crevasse in the Alps, so I knew exactly what to do. And so I was able to sort of explain rope work and things like I did. That was obviously just right. I mean, I didn't realise the time was just right. The fact I'd already driven dogs helped, obviously. And as I say, this amazing background I had of people, which again, I didn't realise all these people and their input into Bass at the time, but, you know.
This was 1971, you were
71, now, I went south.
22,
yeah. 23? Yeah.
So what happened next? That you got the you did the medical.
I did a medical. I then actually went straight to Iceland. Actually, I was actually on a trip across. We were doing a trip across the Vatnajökull, across the glacier. And so I did that, and then I came back in September. So after I left St. Paul's, I had the interview. I did this. Came back in September, and then sailed on the Bransfield. First week in October.
And did you know at that point where you were heading?
Yes, I did. Yeah. When I went to the Cambridge conference, I up until then I didn't, but then I knew I was going to Halley. And
what are your memories of the conference 40 years ago?
It was at Corpus Christi. Really interesting, actually, because again, it was I was memories really of the people I met of ex-FIDs. I met Raymond Priestley, which, of course, I knew from books and nothing else, and just this remarkable person. Met Wally Herbert, just come back from doing a lecture tour about his crossing of the Arctic. So that's what I remembered mainly. And also incredible camaraderie, really, from all the new FIDs who I'd never met before. And this mix with these wonderful names and the new people. And it just, the week went almost like a blur, really. I can't really remember too many of the talks, to be honest. But I do remember, you know, meeting all these people. And
what struck you about Priestley?
The awe, I suppose, that it was a bloke who was with Scott. I actually read the book. But also his interest in new FIDs, if you like. And I wrote him, and of course, sadly, he died while I was south. But I wrote him a letter, and he actually wrote back and just, you know, said, you know, have a great time, and so on and so forth. And of course, just being with Fuchs as well, it's again that sort of era. Really quite remarkable, actually. But I think it was this mix of new and young, and just sheer camaraderie. As I say, to be honest, the day to day, minute to minute things, I really can't remember much about it.
Do you remember any particular health and safety training?
None at all. None whatsoever. No, none whatsoever. And it was actually one of the things, going back to one of your earlier questions, that, again, I took from St. Paul's, really, on the training of the outdoor pursuit side there, was at Cygni. I insisted on taking everybody out and doing stretcher lowering exercises, rope exercises, camping. So, because I was very conscious that we didn't do any of this, really. In fact, when I went to Rothera at a later time, I actually started an outdoor program, which still runs today, because I just felt the lads were going south. I mean, I went out with dogs within a week of getting on base. I knew what I was doing. That sounds... I had an idea of what I was doing. Most of the lads had no clue, you know, and they were just off, gone.
Were you a bit horrified at the lack of preparation?
I was a little. I must admit, I was a little. But I always assumed it would be more later, if you see what I mean. Because in the end day, again, of course, things were later, because we didn't get anything in Cambridge, everything we got in the Falklands. So it was always next week. And I suppose subconsciously, I assumed that's what would happen, that, you know, in a few weeks' time, I would know more, and then a few weeks' time, I would know a bit more. And, well, of course, actually didn't. And, of course, so events always overtake it. I mean, you know, big effort in Stanley getting all the bits. And then as soon as you arrive on base, of course, the great frenetic efforts of relief, which you don't really contemplate beforehand. So, you know, all these things push along, and bits like health and safety and training just...
One day.
Yeah, it'll happen. Mm. But,
yeah. So when you got to Halley, what was your first impression?
Overwhelmed, I suppose. The flatness, actually, just incredible. You know, I couldn't. I mean, obviously, I'd read about it and people had told me about it and all the thing. But it's overwhelming when you just land on this ice shelf, and the base then was about, I don't know, it wasn't that far away. It was about 4 miles from the landing site. But it's just this vastness, you know, the all sky and flat ice, and just quite. That was what really got me, I think, was just the vastness of the place. And I remember that the second day, I'd gone up to base with the dogs, and there was an incredible sort of Fata Morgana. There was an amazing inversion of the icebergs, and they were all floating up in the sky. And you just wonder what the hell you come to. You know, it's really quite incredible. But I mean, it was also, again, I was so impressed with the professionalism of everybody, because everybody seemed to know what they were doing, and the whole thing just went. Nobody actually gave you instructions. You know, well, they did, of course. You know, can you help there or can you help? But the whole thing just worked. And I think that was one of the things that always has amazed me with FIDS. It just works. You know, you just get a bunch of lads together and it just happens. No big discussion. You have a big chatter to start with. But then once people decide this is the way we're going to do it, this is the way it's done.
What generation of Halley was that in 71?
That was the second base. Grillage Village.
Grillage Village, yeah.
Yeah.
And was it underground by then?
Oh, yes, very much so.
So here you are, you've got two psychological impacts on you. One is the vastness and the flatness. Mm. And the second one is having to live as a troglodyte.
Yeah, and with a bunk room with no roof, really. I was looking straight up to the ice cave. Yeah, and the top had all gone, really. It was in a pretty sad state, actually, Grillage Village then. But it was, again, I'd known about it, in fact. Yes, one of the chaps at the conference was Ricky. Ricky Chin had told me about it. And so I was sort of prepared for it. But actually, it was just part of what I expected, you know. But it was, again, things that I really hadn't... I think about now came as shocks, because it was just this assumption, A, that you knew you were doing, and B, that you would just do it. I mean, I remember Paul Brangham, who was the chippy, that he said, yeah, under that bit of snow there, that's the extension for the dog tunnel, and over there you need to fit that. And you know, and you just try to absorb all this huge amount of information, and they just assume you would just do it, which has all been done, of course, you know.
So you're literally lying on your bunk looking at ice.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And so was the base awash then? Because that would have been melting.
No. But Bruce, who was the diesel mechanic, was just beginning to have floods then, yeah. It was, but the rest of the base, no, that was fine. And many of the areas, I mean, like the dining room and the lounge were still in really good nick, still in really good order. But the bunks rooms were suffering, and the jenny shed was just beginning to. So it was much worse at the end of my year than it was the start. So.
It began to tilt on the...
Yeah.
The floor was no longer level.
Yeah, that's right. It was beginning to heave up and down.
Did you mind living underground?
No, not at all. Not at all. Didn't really
underground, under ice.
Under ice, didn't really bother. Didn't really even think about it, to be honest. I mean, I spent an awful lot of time out, of course, with the dogs, and so I was, you know, I could imagine actually, and I did think about it. You know, people, some of like the geophysicists and things like that, which did spend most of their time in the base, you know, because that was their job basically, and I did feel that could be a bit of a struggle. I felt I had the right job. Put it that way.
Well, you were out quite a lot, and I'll perhaps pick up on one or two of the notes I've got from some of the base reports I've been sent of your era there. There's a word in that base report which nobody seems to have ever heard before. The word is grabbing.
Grabbing?
In the biology report.
Yeah.
You don't know.
I do. Well, I mean, the grabbing was off the end of the... It was grabbing, literally, down in the ocean.
Grabbing what?
Bottom samples, basically. Sediment.
For biologists to study.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was no biologist there, but there... I mean... We all did a bit of biology. I mean, I did the bird reports and bits and pieces like that. And a couple of people did grab off the ice edge, off the sea ice rather than the cliff edge, on sediments and things like that. So there was bits of biology done. Now, what the background to that was, I've no idea. Whether it had been asked by the head office at some time and we just carried on, I've no idea. But I mean, I did a biology report, which was essentially birds. You know, because overflying.
How does one grab in the Antarctic?
Well, I mean, I know how you do it properly. We used to do it at Signy a lot. You have a small grab like thing, which is on a double cable. You lower it down, pull one, and that closes it up, and you bring it up, and you just literally put a glass tube in that, seal the glass tube, and that's your grab. But how quite they did it, though, you know, the early years, I'm not sure.
And was that then sent back to?
Sent back to Bass and whatever happened, I've no idea. Well, Monk's Wood in those days. So
it would have gone on the next ship?
Yes, yeah.
No, well, what was this bird work you were doing? Was this in your own time?
In my own time. It was literally just overflying bird, because there was an awful lot fascinating, because you obviously had birds like skuas and Dominican gulls on the base, on the gash heap and on the seal pile. But you had overflying Antarctic petrels, snow petrels, which just seemed to be flying to nowhere. But of course, I learned afterwards, of course, they fly to the Therons. There's nesting sites of the Therons. And I was just fascinated by this movement. And also whales, huge numbers of whales alongside the ice cliff at Halley, mainly southern bottlenose, but, you know, minkers as well. So I used to do numbers and, you know, and you'd see them a lot when you were a dog, so you could hear them. You know, so
you could hear them?
Yeah, you could hear them.
Yeah,
bless them.
So was this part of an agreed program before you went south?
No, this was
just something you're doing as a train spotter.
Well, again, it all came. I mean, I did lots of things. I started doing accumulation studies as well, because, if you like, the whole thing we were working to, which would have been the Shackletons, wasn't there. It suddenly didn't come. The only thing we'd done on that, which was almost a disaster, we were looking for a new route up the Hin Zone, between the ice shelf and the inland ice, and we lost the dog team.
I'll come to that in a moment.
Yeah, so that was really the only work, if you like, towards the Shackletons, and then we had the information the aircraft weren't coming. So we basically, you know, we did a survey, we took people out, you know, we did all sorts of things, and I just felt these other things were, you know, would have been interesting.
So were you filling time? Because Andy Smith sent me a note saying, ask Dave how he spent his time being one of two GAs on a base with no field programme.
Absolutely. It was, and all right, I got involved in some very strange projects, like rescuing an old tractor that had gone down a crevasse 7 years earlier. But it was filling time, really. But it was also interest, because many of these things were happening and nobody, because there wasn't a biologist, nobody was noting them. And I just thought they were something that should be noted. And generally interest for the, you know, for the future, really.
So that information would have gone back to Bass?
Yes, it did. Yeah, I actually
was it recognised by Bass?
Yes, I wrote a proper Bass report on it.
Yeah.
Just purely observation and nothing more than that.
Yeah,
just felt it was interesting, really.
Let's talk about the hobbits then. I don't know much about this. I've read a little bit about it, but. It was one of those things, wasn't it? Tell me the story.
Myself and Jack Donaldson, who was the other GA, we'd been asked to look at a new route up through the Hin Zone, or a route that had been done earlier by Graham Wright, but been done several years earlier. And we needed a route up the Hin Zone to either come back from the shacks or as escape or whatever. And also there was still a plan to take heavy vehicles at some stage. Mm. So we were asked to find a route up the inland ice and basically flag any crevasse that was a tractor eater. Well, The first start, I mean, the first bit of it, the place was riddled with crevasses. We took, I can't remember any flags, something like 50, because we thought that would be plenty to mark. We run out of flags and I could still see the first one. That's how many crevasses. It was just riddled. The place was like a minefield. We got through what we thought was the worst and was on the sort of uphill, slow uphill thing. And we're flogging our way up, really, in soft snow, and it was, you know, a real flog uphill. But apparently, relatively crevassy, and what crevasses there were, we'd come across, were coming straight across us. We were crossing, absolutely no problem at all. And because it was, I had my head down, we're pushing, and Jack was leading at that time. I'd been leading in the morning. We'd taken over because it was hard work leading. And I looked up, and he was sitting on the snow. And I thought, what's going on? And I just in my head, I thought, oh, you know, perhaps he's fallen over and the dog team's run off, whatever. I mean, I didn't, you know, really sort of think. Anyway, I got to him. And, of course, he was sitting there literally like this, with his feet in the crevasse and sitting there. And Toby Stoneham, who was the other lad who was with him, was rolled to one side. And, of course, obviously it became obviously then the sledge had gone through. And from talking to them, the back of the sledge had gone through. The weight of the sledge had just pulled the dogs in after him. As soon as I got to him, obviously got those two okay, and I thought, right, well, I'll abseil down because there's probably a snow bridge or something and they'll be just down there. And well, I abseiled down and I had about 120 feet of rope and it was just spinning in space. It was just black. It was nothing. There was no sound, absolutely nothing. So Juma back out again. And that part of the story we got. You know, Jack and Toby, obviously, we joined. We went straight back to base, actually, because the base was about 40 miles, 50 miles away. So we sledged back to base, basically, just get them back, you know, because obviously we couldn't carry on with just one team and three blokes, as it were. So, and then, about 2 or 3 weeks after, we took two vehicles up with another dog team on the route we tracked up. So we got up there. Not easily. We have found lots of more holes. It was just the whole thing was impossible. But we got back to the hole, really, just obviously to see what we could, if we could recover anything off the sledge, because we had quite a lot of stuff with us, like field lights and bits and bobs, and also to try and map out what was going on. We got there and we did a full survey of the thing, and what Jack had been desperately unlucky. The crevasse had come across, and then for about 30 metres, it had done literally a 90-degree loop like that. And he'd hit it exactly parallel on the bit that was, you know, level with him, and of course, that's what had gone through. And it wasn't that wide. I mean, 4 or 5 feet wide at the top, something like that. Anyway, we got the vehicle attached up, backed it up, and lowered a winch down. And had two railway sleepers across the top for a small ladder to help us out, and also the block for the winch. I put a chest harness on and then lowered me down. It was 180 feet to where the dogs hit, because I was standing on the dogs, and by then it was really, I mean, it was like this, it was really narrow. And it was just a huge bowl. The top was about, say, 5 feet wide for about 20 feet, I suppose, and then just barreled out to this huge sort of bottle, and then
like a cavern,
and it was enormous. I'm saying no soap bridge, it was just clear 480 feet. The dogs obviously died instantly, they were all folded up underneath me. Sledge had all been compressed, and obviously, I sent things up like cameras, but they were all destroyed. It was all, you know, completely
small. It was a complete wreck, wasn't it?
Okay, yeah. And it really was, it was awesome, but as I say, it was just this. Incredibly unlucky. I mean, if he crossed it 90 degrees, back of the sledge had gone down, he'd have carried on no problem at all. But just hitting it parallel. And I mean, again, there's always people, oh, you should have seen this. And I looked at it in the sun angle, as low sun that I looked at it, and there was no indication of it there at all. You know, it would have been impossible to see it, you know. But that basically ended the search for a route up onto the inland ice, basically, because it was riddled. You know.
Well, did you regard going down that hole for the first time, and indeed the second time, as being dangerous?
Yeah. Yes, but I'd been down crevasses before in the Alps, and so that didn't bother me.
The first time you were hoping to find dogs that were still alive.
Yes. Yeah. When I went over the top first time, I looked down. It was dark. You know, I mean, that. You know, it does take time for your eyes to get adjusted. But in the way previous experience, apart from big, big ones, most crevasses that size have snow bridges in, you know, collapsed tops, whatever. And I fully expected to see the dogs. Okay, and there might have been a few dead or what injured, but I fully expected to see them laying on a snow bridge or whatever. But A, there was absolutely no sound at all. As I could obviously couldn't see the bottom. I just saw all I could see was the end of my rope spinning in space. And I thought, yeah, okay. Time I wasn't here, really. I spend my life being frightened, actually, but it keeps me sharp, I suppose.
You weren't base commander at that point, but you still had to weigh up the decision about whether to go down the first time. And I can see the point behind that. But the decision to go down the second time, that was one man's life against maybe some equipment.
Yeah. I mean, yes. The only thing that really concerned me was that I looked at the winch and then they'd forgotten to put the brake on. That did concern me a little. I didn't really have a problem with it. I mean, I'm not saying I wasn't nervous. I was always nervous. I'm, you know, I still do what I do today, you know. I am always nervous on these things.
Have there been any precedents, other instances of using a winch to go down to a crevasse to see what was
not
down there?
Not that I'm aware of.
So you were breaking new ground?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, yeah.
Would you do that now, in the light of extra experience? Would you still go over the edge to get stuff off?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, probably.
So you would?
Probably.
From a sledge?
Yeah, probably, but also, because of that time, you know, there was also... You know, obviously, we didn't know the aircraft had been cancelled at that time. So we were still worrying about a route, if you like. Mm. You know, and the more we knew about this route, the better, obviously, because we really began to find out that it was a nightmare. So there was still that side to it. You know, if you like, we were still thinking, oh, well, we need a route up or down, you know, as an escape from the shacks, if you like, or a heavy vehicle route. Mm. Well, obviously, this was rapidly beginning to... decide it wasn't available.
Having lost a sledge and a team, and you had to get back, presumably half your supplies were down the bottom of this crevasse by now. Right. So were you having supply problems getting
out? No, because we'd only just started. We'd only been out, I can't remember exactly, but about 5 or 6 days. So we were only just into the supplies. So one sledge, we had plenty of supplies. And we had the tent on my sledge. So, you know, it felt like we had everything we needed on my sledge. But you do that consciously. You do swap your loads around. So we did it right, if you like. So because we were relatively close to base, it wasn't a problem. I mean, I was a bit worried about Jack, and not Toby particularly, but Jack. And I think it did affected him mentally, really. Again, not particularly the fear, but just the loss of the team and the loss of the, you know, and it all.
This is Jack.
Jack Donaldson.
Well, that was my next question, was how does that filter back to the base when you lose a complete team of dogs?
There was a lot of unfair criticism, you know. And it happens still today, people say, oh, he was the one who went down a crevasse. And I satisfied myself very early that not because I was looking to absolve Jack, but because obviously I want to know where this bloody crevasse went and everything else. You couldn't see it. You really could not see it. And we'd been crossing crevasses the whole day, but at 90 degrees. There was really no reason to... And it was just in a flat plain. In fact, there was every reason not to have crevasses. It was getting that sort of territory, you know. But there is a lot. Was a lot of criticism. Oh, yeah, well, he should have seen it.
This is from your colleagues.
Yeah, and not direct criticism, but, you know, he should have... You know, we'd have seen that, this sort of thing. And it was sad because and Jack went into himself a bit and after that and really basically flew a bar stool after that, you know, and didn't do a lot more.
Did they split the base?
No, not really. No, it didn't.
Were you aware of the base commander at that time dealing with the situation?
Andy, yeah. Andy Smith. He just... Andy was a very... very level-headed, and just got on with it, basically, which was obviously, in retrospect, exactly what was required. I must admit, I was a bit concerned, still thinking of the shacks coming up, but then that, of course, all disappeared, if you like. But Jack was just, and I'm not sure what went on between Andy and Jack, and whether he was talked to or whatever. I don't know, but I know it did affect Jack hugely. And then, of course, the problem was that when the shacks were cancelled, there was nothing to look forward to. And I think I got involved in all sorts of things, but Jack didn't really get involved in anything. And he went home, and I don't think he's ever been seen again. Mm. You know, which was really sad. And I think it was all to do with this accident, really, because, you know, whether he blamed himself, I don't think he was. As far as I was concerned, he was blameless. You know.
Do you think the gossip at base got to him?
I do. I think so. Or the innuendo. Yeah, I think so.
So yeah. That was a bit of a weakness in the Bass.
It was
infrastructure, really. That there's no training to say, you know, if anybody has a close call.
That's right.
You don't criticise.
No, that's right. It's, you know, there's a way of dealing with it, and it's easy. I mean, you know, he didn't help himself by withdrawing, if you like. But then, if you like, that's the same as sort of post-traumatic stress. You know, mm-hmm. It's the same. You know, obviously, it's not as dramatic as that. But in retrospect, it did affect Jack.
Usually, after a tragedy, and you know, fortunately, this wasn't a human tragedy. Mm. More often than not, there's a case of Bass adjusting its procedures to avoid it happening again. Was there any possibility of that at all?
None at all. No, I mean, if you like, the fact that the project was cancelled because of the aircraft was the end of the thing.
Overall,
so it didn't
that.
Need looking at anymore. Mm. But I mean, again, the place was a nightmare. I'm going to say, we ran out of flags. I could still see the first flag. It was just a nightmare.
And was it a close call for the human beings? Could you have...
It was for Jack, yeah. I mean, it was for Toby, because the sledge... Again, obviously, I didn't see it, but the sledge dropped. And as it dropped, Toby was actually sitting on the front, rolled to one side. Jack, who was on his skis alongside, had a dongler on the handlebar, and it fortunately just popped off as the sledge dropped from underneath him. And he literally was sitting with his... Well, when I got there, he was sitting there with his feet in their crevasse and sitting on the edge. And, of course, they'd gone dead. There was absolutely no chance. I mean, it was a killer.
So he was close to going down.
He really was
after
close,
the
yeah,
sledge.
Yeah, yeah.
Which probably explains his behaviour afterwards.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, and the problem was that we'd, again, what hadn't helped, we were getting depth all that morning as well, where you got the top 4 inches collapse. So... That would have probably, when the top of the crevasse had gone, that would have been the sound as well. So, you know, you'd had these combinations anyway, and we knew it was really holy because, we'll say, we'd had all these holes before. They were lucky. They were lucky.
Was that before or after the rescue of the international?
Before.
So this tractor had gone down in 1969.
Yes, a long time before. Yeah, that's right.
3 years earlier.
Yeah.
So who hatched the plan to get it out?
Bruce Blackwell, who was the diesel mechanic, and Bruce had been talking about this all summer, actually. He had obviously been in his mind a while.
Was anybody listening?
Not really. but then it all became, he'd obviously put a whole plan to Andy, and the part that the strength of the plan was that he didn't want to involve any Bass kit, if you like. It would be dug out, and we would do it all by hand. That was the thing. There was myself, Bruce, Toby, and then Ian Berry. We were going to go. I was going to go as, if you like, health and safety, because again we had to cross the end zone, had to get it across, and then get our kit across, and then get back. And then we did it literally at the end of winter, so bloody cold. But we did it because obviously the services were good, and of course I had no commitment then, no field commitment. So apart from just looking after the dogs and running training teams and things like that, I actually had no long term commitment. So he'd obviously convinced Andy. I'm not sure Fuchs was fully aware of it until we actually got it out, but. That's another story. And then off we went. And we did this training run to go down there. We manhauled, basically. We took a tractor as far as the edge of the hinge zone. and then we manhauled in to have a look at it to make sure it was accessible. We'd sorted a route across the Hind Zone, which of course at that time of year was rock solid, so there were no real problems at all. And then we came back to do the trip, if you like, which was a wonderful trip. It was amazing.
Well, give me the gist of it.
Well, basically, we went in with a tractor, which is how we had to take a tractor because we needed the winch and things like that. And we got there and we manhauled all the kit in on big sledges and things. It was a hell of a pull getting it in there. And then we dug it out, literally. We dug the top of the crevasse off. We dug a ramp. We lost it twice. We got it up to the edge and it went back in. We got it up to the edge and it went back in.
Winching it up.
Went and broke, and the cable broke, the block broke. And then we were using a turfer, a hand turfer. One of these big, it's like a sort of winch which eats the metal. It pulls the cable. And we did that and we got her out. Out she came. And then the amazing thing is we got her out on the surface, put a new battery in, and it started first turn of the key, which was really quite incredible. In fact, the falling back down had actually helped us because it had loosened everything up. Because the initials, it was a hell of a job moving it because it had jammed. It had jammed across with the blade on one side of the crevasse and the back on the other side of the crevasse. By falling down, which obviously we did too deliberately, eased it. But then we had to get it back, and that was actually really quite an interesting because we drove it back. And in fact, I skied in front as a crevasse pro, if you like. And the lads drove the tractor with wires from the back.
Yeah. Was that because you? Why was that?
Well, we were terrified of it going down another hole.
Okay.
But again, we were freaked out by huge depth thaw every few minutes. It all standing on his shivering.
But huge
depth thaw when the service collapses about 4 inches.
Oh, right.
Big crystals. But then we got it back to the big chasm, if you like, which is the main part of the Hind Zone. And then we had really no idea. We got it down. We lowered it down. And then we thought, how are we going to get it out the other side? Well, Bruce had the idea. What we do is turn it round, run the winch cable up to the top of the chasm, put it round a block, run it back, and literally let it climb out on its own winch, which we did. We got it started, put it in gear, and I think it chugged its way up and was halfway up. The dead man that was holding it started to fold up. So, oh no, we thought the whole thing would go back down. It didn't. It all jammed together and the thing just climbed itself over the top.
A dead man is a bit like a sort of miniature drilling rig, is it?
Yeah, well, it's basically like it's an anchor, essentially.
Mm.
It's a good anchor.
In the ice.
Yeah, and you normally use things like you used to use old railway sleepers and things like that. And this thing had started to split as the thing was halfway up. There was no way, nothing we could do with it because the thing was doing it itself, basically. But it did, it climbed over the top and we were fine. It was amazing, actually. And then, of course, we got it back, and that's when we, sent the thing off to Fuchs, and congratulations.
Yeah, well, 2 points. One is that you didn't even need to put any more antifreeze in the radiator when you dug it up. And secondly, I think this is a note from Fuchs, which says, first, best recovery of a tractor that I have known. Fuchs. 30th of January 1973.
That's right. Absolutely blessing.
A little note on the bottom of your Blackhurst report.
No, it was a wonderful trip, actually. Two great companions and just, it was fit ingenuity at its top level, basically. Because we just did it by hand. We didn't commit any, apart from the vehicle that took us to the edge, and then we manhauled the whole way after that and did it ourselves.
And was it in good working order for the rest of the season?
Well, it was for 2 years until Pete Woody dropped it through the sea ice some years later. Until then, it was perfect. And it actually worked fully in its relief as well. Yeah.
Let's take a pause.
Yes, certainly.